Well, good evening, everyone. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the Society Library. It's wonderful to see such a great crowd here tonight. I want to welcome many of you back to our second event in the members' room since we started our fall season. We had our first one on Sunday. And for those of you who didn't notice when you came up the stairs, got off the elevator, on the way out, if you haven't had a chance to look, have a glance up into the stairwell. The skylight has been opened. We restored it over the summer thanks to a generous contribution of the Peluso family, and it's a really lovely architectural feature of the library that we've brought back. It's also the time of year when I have to thank our members for their ongoing support of the library, and just to remind you all that this is a crucial year to continue your support of the library for all the programs, events like tonight's, and programs in the children's library, the collections, and everything we do. It's also my pleasure to introduce Harriet Shapiro, our head of exhibitions and the curator of the wonderful Literary Lives exhibition, which is currently on display and will be for a number of more months. Harriet Shapiro.
Good evening, everyone. It gives me a special pleasure to welcome library members and guests to this evening's program, A Conversation with Shirley Hazard and Professor Robert Harrison. Literary Lives, on view in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, just outside the members' reading room, celebrates two acclaimed literary talents, both members of the New York Society Library, Shirley Hazard and Frances Stiegmuller. Theirs was a world marked by high civility, grace, and an enduring dedication to literature. Shirley Hazard, a trustee of this library since 1973, is one of the world's most luminous literary talents. She has written 11 books, including the novels The Bay of Noon and The Transit of Venus. In 2004, for The Great Fire, Hazard won the National Book Award for Fiction and the Miles Franklin Literary Award. We cannot speak of Shirley Hazard without paying homage to her late husband, the writer and translator, Frances Stiegmuller. The pair were introduced to each other by Muriel Spark, whose unerring instincts for matchmaking led to one of the happiest literary unions on record. A leading Flaubert scholar, it was Stiegmuller who introduced Flaubert, Cocteau, and de Maupassant to the post-war English-speaking world. On a private note, it was Stiegmuller who inserted into his marriage the Bear of Croisset, Flaubert, turning their marriage, as Shirley has said, into a ménage à trois. Leading tonight's conversation with Shirley Hazard is Professor Robert Harrison. Professor Harrison is head of the Department of French and Italian at Stanford University, where he holds the Rosina Pierotti Chair. He is a critically acclaimed writer whose books, translated into French, Italian, German, and Japanese, include The Body of Beatrix, Forests, The Shadow of Civilization, The Dominion of the Dead, and Gardens, an Essay on the Human Condition. Professor Harrison is also the composer, lyricist, and lead guitarist for the rock band Glass Wave. His lightly satiric chansons are riffs on such classics as Pride and Prejudice, Moby Dick, The Iliad, and Lolita. We are grateful that Professor Harrison has flown across the country to talk tonight with Shirley Hazard. Before I turn the evening over to our guests, let me just say that one of the great joys of my life was working on Literary Lives. Shirley tells me that the day before Francis's death, they were reading Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra on their terrace in Capri, looking out over the bright waters of the Tyrrhenian Sea. You can't imagine how happy we were, she said. Shirley, let me just say that you can't imagine how happy we are to have you here with us once again at the library. Thank you, Professor Harrison.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome you all again. I know some of you, very few of you, and many of you are not known to me personally, but I understand that we're all a community here, I'm assuming, of readers. And I would just like to say something about the active reading, which brings us all together here. And I feel that those people who, for one reason or another, don't read inhabit one single world, whereas readers inhabit a multiplicity of worlds, in fact, a whole proliferation of different worlds, because each book, especially the kinds of books that Shirley Hazard has gifted us with, are worlds unto themselves, and those of us who have cultivated the art of reading can enter at will into this great array of worlds that is the history of literature. And we will be talking about some of those books with Shirley, but Shirley's life also is one that in its own biography has inhabited quite a plurality of different worlds, and I thought it would be desirable to review just briefly before we turn to matters literary how many worlds Shirley has come to us through, and beginning with her childhood in Australia, which is a country that she has herself declared she felt always a stranger in, not a true homeland, not your true spiritual homeland, as I gather. I believe that your spiritual homeland is one that you discovered later in life when you moved to Italy, and I do want to talk at length about Italy, which is where Shirley and I first met in 2003, and where we spent the most of our friendship, actually, in the city of Rome, and we will talk about that. But Shirley, if you don't mind, the question I would like to begin with is your recollections of World War II, but not just in general, but the importance that Winston Churchill had for you when you would listen to his radio speeches.
Yes, how interesting. Yes, thank you. I'm glad to talk about that.
And the reason I want to know about that is because Winston Churchill had a very marked literary sensibility,
yes,
and he had a use of the English language which would not have been possible had he not been nurtured on literature, and he marshaled the English language into battle,
yes,
as someone once said.
Yes, yes. And should I say something about
absolutely.
It?
Yes, absolutely.
And this was for all of us of my generation. I was a child when the World War II broke out, but I somehow, it was the English language did somehow get itself together. And some of these people, of course, had not entirely lovable reputations or characters. And yet it was something where people felt there was no alternative. They had to get together. And I was, as I say, a child, but I remember very vividly all this and how we were always crouched in front of the shortwave radio to find out what was happening next, and also to hear a vive voix, to hear these extraordinary people speaking, and of course Churchill above all was this, and he was perhaps the last great orator in our language that we will ever know, because people now became, I think, a bit embarrassed about being great orators. And some of them still speak well, but mostly they ought to be embarrassed about the way they speak, these politicians. Anyway, I remember it very, very vividly, many, many details about the war, and also how we somehow didn't believe we could possibly be beaten. I don't think it was understood quite how close all this was, but I do think that added something to the idea of victory, that there was no question that we were going to be beaten, that we were not going to be beaten by these creeps who were on the other side. But I grew up with that, and then I was still at school when the war ended, though it was very near the end of my school days, which were the end of all school for me. Those days were all the ever school I had, because my father was posted abroad quite soon after the end of the Second World War, and we went We were 5 weeks on a little ship going to Japan. Japan had been occupied, and part of what my father was doing was to go and be in this occupied country and somehow settle things around and so on. And there was this long trip, which 5 weeks on a small ship, and I just loved every moment of it. We'd been stuck in Australia for all this time, and it wasn't a very lively place then. And here there's this 5 weeks on board a ship, and really stopping almost nowhere except for water. So those were my early days. I had all kinds of things that never would have happened to me if there hadn't been World War.
And not to introduce too much disenchantment, but when you did arrive in Japan, one of the first places that you were taken to visit was Hiroshima.
That's right. That's right. And it was strange. We arrived at the port of Hiroshima, which is Kure, city of Kure. And, of course, there were bombarded ships everywhere lying around in the water. And it was a world that expected that. I don't say we would have been disappointed if we hadn't been there, but still, we expected the signs of war because we had grown up with that and there should be evidence of it. And all that seems, well, I can't say it even seems terribly far away to me now, but what seems in that far away to me is me, the me I was then. It's changed a lot since those days.
The adventures you went on to have after leaving Australia in 1947, I believe, and then being enlisted to work for the British intelligence
at a very early age, in Hong Kong. Yes, it was wonderful.
It was, yeah. And all along, however, although your education was truncated in the sense that you left school, I think at age 16, if I'm not mistaken?
I was just barely 16 when I left school.
And that could be a blessing in disguise in the
sense that... It was a blessing completely undisguised to me.
Because it meant that you were self-educated really primarily through literature.
And
the reading of poetry was one of your main activities in terms of...
Well, I almost feel that I don't remember when I began to read poetry, and I don't mean that I was just reading poetry for children. I understood the quality of great poetry, and it's one of the things I'm most thankful for in my life because it's given me constant pleasure. I remember when I said this to an elderly lady in the city, she said, yes, what on earth would one do waiting for a bus if one didn't have any poetry? It can show many uses great poetry can have. But I do, yes, I remember all those things vividly, but especially I remember that I already understood what beautiful poetry was, and I've never lost not only to pass the time when I'm waiting for the bus, I've never lost the power of that in my life.
Well, those of you who are friends with Shirley will know what an extraordinary memory she has for recital of poetry. And I remember a few years ago after she left your house, Francie, and had forgotten her wallet and didn't have the money for the cab, so she walked back to her apartment reciting Shakespeare's sonnets all the way. And I think you went through about 30 of them from what you told me.
Be careful, I might start up again.
Yes, I think I am.
Yes. No, it's been a great thing of, I can say an interior life, but also even sometimes when I'm alone or walking around or something, I can say these great things that comfort me, and they make you feel better than you might be. But it's,
So surely going a little bit quickly through the main biographical moments, your stay at the UN was not a big thrill for you.
Well, I would have been pleased to be thrilled, but they put me in the dungeons and there I stayed. So I was quite glad to leave, really, and because I became, somebody there said to me, you should thank them. If they had ever done anything for you, you would never have become a writer. And I think there was something in that. But I didn't do a single useful thing while I was there. I did a lot of things But they were dungeon things, yeah. You know.
But they did do one thing for you, is that they understood that you spoke Italian. That's and they sent you to Italy.
Yes, because Italy had not come into the United Nations then. It was just coming in. It had been belligerent in the war, you know, and it when suddenly Italy became part of the UN, they didn't have anybody in there speaking Italian. And this was a very pleasant thing for me. And they came one day and said that they were setting up an office in Italy for a particular reason. It was the Suez Crisis. And they had a base, the United Nations had a base for the Italians component of this. And they suddenly found me and then said, well, on Thursday you're going to Italy. And I didn't say I've forgotten, because I had never been in Italy, but I had learnt the language long ago. But I didn't say I've forgotten everything. I had the sense just to keep quiet and let the chips fall where they certainly later may. But it was a marvellous sort of act of God, really, that I went there, and I knew immediately. Somebody said to me, in fact, you won't go back. And I did come back. I had to come back and earn my living in New York at the UN. But it was true. I didn't come back the person that I was, and I knew I had Italy in my life, and it stayed there.
Yeah, and I was thinking, how many of your published books have Italy in the title, or at least allude
really?
To Italy? Yes. The evening of the holiday is a line from Leopardi.
Yes, it's like true.
I'm going to ask you about him in a moment. The Bay of Noon is Naples.
Yes.
There is the Green on Capri, the Ancient Shore.
Yes, it's true.
Well, that's already quite a few. I don't know if there's a fifth one, but that's...
I've never thought of it that way, but it's true.
It all revolves around... Yes. So the evening of the holiday is a novel, I believe, that you published in 1970, if I... What matters the year? What matters is that La Sera del Dì di Festa,
yes,
is a verse from Giacomo,
yes,
Leopardi, early 19th century Italian poet. And in fact, Jonathan Galassi, your publisher at Farrar Straus, will come out with a new translation of all of Leopardi's poetry. And as we speak, I think it's coming out.
And he's wonderful,
and
Jonathan.
You'll hear a lot,
yes,
about that. But Leopardi is someone that you actually sat down to learn Italian in order to read Leopardi in,
absolutely,
Italian, is that right?
That is absolutely true, and I think that's true of many people, that they have read something in another language and loved it so much they wanted to learn what the language was, and that's how I came to Leopardi.
And Leopardi is a notorious, he's probably the most pessimistic person of the 19th century. And yet, for all his despair about finding happiness and the idea that life is...
I don't think he ever uses the word happiness in his work. Yes.
Yeah, except to denounce it as a deception.
Oh, except to say never had any happiness. Yeah.
But this never got in your way of appreciating him. This never bothered... In fact, it doesn't bother very many people about Leopardi that he was such a pessimist, because there's an extraordinary beauty in his lyrics,
yes,
and lyricism,
yes,
that one can't take... Many people think that they cannot take seriously his pessimism because the poetry is too beautiful.
But isn't it strange? It is. You don't readily think of him as pessimistic, not the first thing you think of. And then when you remember what the lines are, you realize he wasn't a fun person. And he had a rather short life, and really very little in it that was pleasurable to him. Yes.
In fact, Leopardi, like Shirley, was an avid reader when he was young, even more so because he learned Greek and Latin on his own in his father's,
yes,
library. His father,
yes,
had one of the,
yes,
biggest libraries in Europe, private libraries. And he was writing hexameters in both Greek and Latin, heroic verse.
It's incredible.
At the age of 12,
yes,
he had composed epic poems. And slowly, slowly, he realized when he was about 18 or 19 that all this study had turned him into a hunchback. He,
yes,
didn't realize that he was,
yes,
becoming a hunchback until it had already become a reality, and that's when he had this...
And it was a tragic thing for,
yes,
him.
It was
it comes into his in his poems too, that he oh my gosh.
You think that's my microphone? No.
Yeah. I'm trying to contribute to the noise. Thank you.
Can I go on?
Thank you.
Sorry, Shirley, but so if that was a turning point for Leopardi, arriving in Italy was somewhat of a turning point for you. Would
yes,
you?
And I, you know, he had such a sad life because of his infirmity, and because really nobody in this world has ever needed human love more than he did. I mean, love with a woman, he didn't know, he really didn't quite know how to bear this deprivation, which he knew was from a common thing, that people, men and women, loved each other and married and so on, and there was nothing like that for him in his life. And he died rather young, and I think we don't have things, as far as I know, we don't have such extremely intense romantic feelings now. I don't think there are so many people who are so, what shall I say, they may have extremely romantic feelings, but their life is not dominated and coloured by that in all the years of their youth now. There are more distractions, but these people were sort of swept up on the beach where they had nothing to comfort them except their own genius and their love of literature, I think, really.
Leopardi was born in Le Marche, which is on the Adriatic coast, but then he migrated to Naples, and is buried very near to where you lived for a long time.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Because you and Francis bought a you bought a villa in Capri.
And he's buried there, you know, yes.
Yes, and he's buried there nearby, no? Mm. So he was a spirit who has been hovering over you for a long time.
Yes, he's hovering around. And also it's never something that once, a literary phenomenon like that one's been very attached to very early in one's life, it might, and often does, stay with people, but it also drifts into all the other things you read, and more mighty things, perhaps, even. But I've never lost this almost sacred feeling about him.
On the question of Italy, Shirley, Francis, your husband, was primarily a French scholar, and with deep attachments to France, and yet after you married, the two of you spent a lot more time in Italy than in France.
Well, first of all, something among the many beautiful things, when we married, I found out that he spoke excellent Italian and was extremely well read in Italian, and he had lived in Italy, and so he loved it, and he felt although we spent quite a lot of time in France, but he felt that life in France, as so many of his friends had died, it wasn't the life that he had, and he always treasured it. We always went to France and so on, but he was ready really to, people thought I distracted him made him into an Italian, but it wasn't true. He was already very learned in Italian and in Italian things and literature and places when we met, and it was he said himself, I think I was ready to move into Italy more than he had been. And so I never had, when people would say, so you took him away from France and so on, but it wasn't true. He never felt that way, and we had lovely times in Italy. And I think of those times now, I can hardly believe of the years that we had where we spent, I mean, we kept our place in New York, obviously, and so on, but we spent so much time in Italy, and he was so familiar with Italian things and spoke excellent Italian, and it wasn't what I had thought before I ever met him. I thought of him almost exclusively as a, a scholar of French things, and he still was. But we had these things in common.
There's two questions I'm curious about. One is what it's like to live with another writer in the same apartment or villa in Capri, and to write the kind of fiction that you wrote while you cohabited with Francis, at the same time that he's working on a book on Cocteau and other things. The style, from my perspective, is very different.
Yes,
and you would have to retreat into a very private space of your own at the same time as you're living with Francis, and both of you would have to do that.
Was that
ever a challenge for you?
No, it was. People used to say this, and how can you work together in those few rooms and things like this? It never was any friction or trouble, and also because we loved what the other one wrote. And I think I can say about Francis, he really rejoiced in what I wrote. And I wouldn't show him what I was writing, whereas he liked to show me what. He would come flourishing some pages, and I'd say, go away, I don't want to read these things now, I'm doing them. But if we made it so easy to be together, and also because we traveled, in Europe especially, we traveled a great deal in the places where both of us had literary context, that we loved to be there also because we had already, in a sense, lived in those places, especially those Italian places. We had already lived in them in our minds, in our souls, you might say, and so we could share this. And I have to say, people did always seem almost sometimes to urge on us, you must be very fed up with each other being at home. And it wasn't a bit like that.
Well, Francis was the great Flaubert scholar, and
yes.
Flaubert has a distinctive aesthetic as a novelist, where he is a virtuoso of description, and he is the one who is always in pursuit of the so-called mot juste,
yes,
the right word. And this imperative to find always that there is a right word for what you're trying to say in fiction, I find very much at work when I read your fiction, that there is a search for the right word, and oftentimes the finding, mostly, you find that right word or the right image or the right metaphor.
Oh, isn't it marvelous when you do find the right word?
Well, the question then would, was Flaubert a very important influence for you as a novelist, or not at all, except indirectly through Francis's...
I wish he were here. He could not have failed to be an influence, and yet Francis never tried to write as Flaubert wrote or anything of the sort. But Francis had an enormous admiration for that, the mot juste, and also for the life of Flaubert. He was much more tolerant about this man who had not been very tolerant in his life and who had been rather awful to the women in his life and seemed to pour scorn on women who had had love for him. And he took them up and he sort of used them and threw them away, I think. And he resented the fact that women would want to go on with the love affairs he started up with them. He was a pill, really, Flaubert.
No, he was. And I was in Rouen two or three years ago, and they took me to visit his grave site.
Yes.
And he's actually buried in the family plot. And it's, he wrote that book of the Idiot de la Famille, the Idiot of the Family, and it's his tombstone is about that high. His mother's and father, everyone else towers over him. So he was really like the idiot de la famille when you look at the tombstone. One had a sense that he really should be disinterred and relocated somewhere, because he had such a horror of the world that he grew up in.
Yes.
And for him to be smothered by his own
But look
larger
how
family in that plot.
But look how it stuck to that family life.
Yes, he did.
And he was rather terrified of any woman coming and taking him out of it. He had these women in his life, but he didn't encourage them at all to have any. In fact, I forget now the occasion, but his friend Bouye, I think it was, sent to him or wrote to him and said, "Watch out, because this woman, who was apparently a very attractive and interesting woman, and she really means to marry you. Look out for this." As if this were some terrible sin that the woman he had been flirting with and so on thought that there might be something more serious in this. But they were on their guard against any kind of affection that would interfere with the life they meant to live. And that aspect of Flaubert is very unattractive. He was using people all the time in various ways.
I know this is an impossible question, but if there is one novelist that you had to point to who was more important to you than any other, does anyone come to mind? Is there anyone?
In what context would this novelist?
For yourself as a writer, as an influence.
Let me think. This is a hard choice because at different times, I've really felt very strongly about this in a different sense from, I think, what you mean. William Maxwell, the novelist who is now dead some years, but he was an influence in my life, not because I ever had the slightest idea of emulating his work, but I emulated what was the expression he used, not about this particular thing, but yes, he said, I said how marvelous it is to read the great novelists, as we were, both he and I were novelists, and I said how marvelous it is to read them. And I said, not because one is going to try and write that way or even imagine writing that way, but, and then I paused and he said, one is moved to emulation. And I thought this was beautiful, that somebody has been able to do this. You don't want to do it the way they've done it or copy or anything of the sort. But it's the idea of, taking words and creating something from them that you yourself can respect and esteem and be glad to read over. It's not always like that, of course. But I remember this. One is moved to emulation. And I think a great deal of art has been that, people realizing somebody has done this and I will do something like it.
For a while, I was convinced that Henry James was a huge influence on you, but you disabused me of that notion early on, that he was not,
well,
actually.
Well, he's never been. Of course, I have a great respect for him, but he's never been a great thing of mine. Many people have, if they were interested at all, have said to me, it must be a great thing for you, and I have never felt that way. I've always felt that he was... now, how should I put it? That he was dodging some essential passion, for instance, in life, I had a feeling about him as if he were hesitating on the page, and I wanted to give him a push, go on with it. I mean, there was some spirit lacking, and he was very cautious in this way.
Yeah, he was very withholding. But he turned that into a sublime style,
yes,
withholding, of course.
And that's what I said. I, of course, have an enormous appreciation for him and admiration, but it wouldn't be if I were going to this famous desert island we're all going to, how crowded it'll be. But it wouldn't be one of his books if I only had 10 books I'm only allowed to have. I don't think he would be one.
Well, this notion that we share in common, I also like a writer who speaks up when they write rather than one who is always whispering,
yes,
and forces you to lean into the page and see what exactly are you trying to tell me. And I understand that there's a certain fascination about withholding, but I,
yes,
like you, I prefer the rather more bold risk taker who will take the risk of saying what
exactly
he or she means.
Yes. Yes.
And that's where a writer like Joseph Conrad has a particular
affection
marvelous. For me. Yeah.
Yes.
And in fact, Conrad, in the preface to one of his books, says, "The work of art," and he means the novel, "must justify itself line by line." And this is something that I feel when I read The Transit of Venus or The Great Fire or any of your short stories, that this is something that you also hold to, that you must justify that book line by line, that every sentence really counts.
I thank you for these words. I'm enormously pleased by them, and I don't feel I belong in that great company, but still that is my intention. And I don't think that novelists should be splurging words. Even when there are novels of great passion and there are even violent passages, I think we should know what we're doing. We shouldn't be indulging ourselves, having our feelings, writing them out. We should still be keeping, no matter how deeply we want to express ourselves, we should be remembering. But this isn't a fun game for us. We're supposed to be saying something that would have a lasting meaning, if possible.
It's another a little slightly controversial. When you look around at where the novel is going nowadays, do you think positively of the evolution of the novel?
I don't know what to say to this. I have various friends, of course, who are novelists and fine writers, and I mentioned Maxwell, who's now been dead many years, but still, I don't think he ever wanted to write a line that he hadn't considered and thought was worth writing for other people to read. But I don't know what to say, because I do get a lot of new novels sent to me, and some of them are quite striking, and I have interest in them, but I don't ever, I almost never find the same excitement, right. Although I might find it, which is a lot, I might find it in a line or a paragraph or something of the sort, and there are really quite marvellous books that I read that are new, but I don't remember them, and maybe that's just me not remembering, but I don't remember them the way I did. Of course, when you're young, you do, and you're very struck by a great novel, as I was by the works of Conrad, especially. I liked when I was extremely young, like them now. But I don't really find so much that I just want to think, well, it's still going on, there's still marvellous things. But of course, I'm not reading everything, and there may be things that are much more important.
I find that many contemporary novelists have lost the art of arriving at what we might call, the grand ending, the grand finale, tying things together, a kind of end to a story that is at once surprising, recapitulating the
yes.
everything that's gone before, and bringing it to that kind of satisfaction of a true conclusion, a conclusion that
yes.
seems inevitable once it takes place. And I find that now, and the Transit of Venus, The Great Fire, these are novels that really have that art of the ending. And it seems to me that is the most neglected aspect of the novel among many contemporary novels
yes.
that I've read. As if it's not important,
yes.
it just drifts off.
Yes.
There
isn't much of a true conclusion.
Right.
Or it's forced in a way you don't quite believe. I know. And I try to do
yes.
something that I think at least is better.
Yeah, the same with poetry. I find that many poets don't know how to end their poems, and the end of the poem is not anywhere as intense as the beginning of the poem nowadays. That was not the case before, where you had the art of the ending, but this is a different issue. But it's important, because I think one of Shirley's great virtues as a storyteller is the respect for the reader, who is expecting, by the time he or she comes to the end of a book, to have some, not just a conclusion, but something which synthesizes everything, and rewards the effort for having made it this far.
Well, also rewards the reader for having taken the trouble to read it, because I think, I shudder to think that my book's included, but how many people put down a book and think, well, that's not the way they used to be or something. But yes, thank goodness, though, people aren't, serious people are going on writing novels, because you might think by now they're saying, well, what's the point of that? Because nowadays everything, many things are thought to have an obligatory point on, you have to come to the end and feel there's been some sort of conclusion or explosion. And yet there are books that are written with so much force that at the end you realize that they didn't need to have an explosion. Right. The book is the explosion. I think Henry James is a bit like that, and I'm not one of the greatest Henry James admirers, but I think he does have, when you get to the end of certain books, you feel, yes, well, nobody else could have written such a thing.
I would like to open up
audience,
the discussion, and invite you to engage Shirley.
Engage you? What about engaging you?
Questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, Ms. Hazard, you mentioned 10 books that you would take to your desert island. Could you give us some titles?
Well, I change them all the time. The 10 books I'm taking to that desert island, I go over them occasionally. I don't mean systematically or anything, but I think, well, I've read such and such a book, maybe so many times, a book I loved, I'll still take it there. And I don't know, it's now, people don't believe in this desert island anymore where you're going. And even I've sort of felt, well, when is this showing up? It's getting a bit late for me to find the desert island. But I do think, well, great books that, even some of them might not be considered great, but I think that there are the great novels, but most of them are either 19th century or, for me, I mean, either 19th century or they are early 20th century. And I don't, this may just be me, but I don't think it is, because these great things that we read with such excitement, I still read with excitement those great, the great novels of the past. And I read a lot of new novels, and some of them are very good and some of them are extremely clever too, and sometimes witty, which is nice. We need that.
Would Jane Eyre make it on your list?
I just read it. Did you know that? I just reread it. And yes.
Yes, sir.
A comment was made around our dinner table.
I'm not hearing this.
A comment was made around our dinner table one evening when someone asked the same question of what would you take to the desert island to read, and the answer was Shirley Hazard.
Oh, how marvelous. Oh, how marvelous. Thank you. I'm a happy cat.
Someone had a hand up in the... I'm sorry. Was that you?
I was getting lost the same question.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Shirley, would you be able to tell us about the
Would you be willing to recite some Leopardi?
I think I might make a fool of myself. I'll think about that. And you might be sorry, because I might go on and on. I don't know that I'll do that at the moment. Next time.
Yes.
One of the things that I love, I'm sure many people love about your book, is the, is it not loud enough?
I'll convey the question.
Great Fire, right? yes. somewhere that at that time was yes. so remote. And so for a young person posted to one of these places, whether it was Hong Kong or Australia, and I myself lived in Japan for 20 years, and yet as I was reading your books, I realized how different an experience that was for a young, I was then young, a younger person now versus just, you know, a few decades ago, because we're so connected yes. to everything, and you can place a phone call or an email in an instant, and so you're never really as isolated as those young people were. So the question that I guess I'm in a long-winded way coming to is, without that remoteness, is there really any possibility, well, of course there's a possibility, but is there a likelihood of the same sort of sense of adventure that your protagonists had? Because even if they were in very banal settings, they weren't always doing something terribly exciting, just being an office clerk in Naples or what have you, it felt like an adventure because the place was so remote from what they knew. And so I just wondered what you thought about now, when all places have sort of merged, yes. is there still room for that sort of
And places are becoming much more alike, I think, too. I think about this quite a lot because when I was young, obviously a million years ago and so on, there wasn't this easy movement. For one thing, the war was on, you know, but there wasn't easy movement around the globe at all. And there wasn't also a feeling of familiarity when you set off. You might be going to be somewhere very uncomfortable, and which nevertheless might be marvelous, but when you set off, you weren't assured that it would be something that you would settle in, or it would be all recognizable as it is today. And that I'm aware of that. Something got lost. Something was gained, I'm sure, but something got lost. And many people have traveled in the world more than ever before. People are charging around the world, looking sometimes in thousands at the same objects. And I'm not trying to condescend or deplore that, but it hasn't the same almost sacred quality that it had for travelers in my very early youth, where I was lucky to be able to go to these extraordinary places because my father was assigned there. And they weren't extraordinary places. And I remember waking up in the inland sea of Japan. I don't mean in the sea, of course, but when I was very, very young, and that was the first place I lived in that I really spent time, first foreign place I really spent time in. And it was absolutely fascinating to me. And the whole, I was more observant perhaps because the colors and the light seemed, yes, from almost another world to me. And I don't think there can be quite that feeling now, because almost anyone who goes to far places now expects to find something that resembles where they came from. The things that can make you comfortable, the things that protect you from having to enter too much into a completely alien or primitive life. And there's not the same sensation. I don't mean I want to be uncomfortable. I just mean that there was a reality that isn't quite there anymore. What do you think?
Well, I also agree with the comment that place is very important in your novels. And, you know, when we were all taught about the five parts of the novel, there's setting, character, plot, speech. Setting was always minimized in its importance vis-a-vis plot
That's
or
strange.
Character. But I think setting is that the novelists whom I like the best are those who give the most amount of importance to setting. And I do agree that places do come alive in your work, because you're sensitive to what is very distinctive and specific to one particular place versus another.
Thank you. Yeah. Because it has always been very important to me, and I think it's particularly because when I was very young and growing up, I was going with my parents then, going to such extraordinary places which hadn't yet become part of the same world we have now. Well, it's still, obviously, there are many great differences, but in those days they were real differences, and one lived quite differently from the life one lived at home.
And that's where... Yes, please.
Oh, I... sort of irrelevant, Shirley, but about place, when we met in Torcello. When we met in Torcello...
Yes,
for weeks,
indeed,
years
ago, yes.
Shirley appeared there and became part of that little inn. It was amazing. The waiters, the guy who runs it... I mean, never left the island at once when there was high water in Venice, got soaking wet, but... The way you made that visit so intimate, not with me, because I knew you so many years, but the people there became part of your world. And it just occurred to me that it was absolutely wonderful to have that.
Oh, thank you. I'm so grateful to have been able to do those things. And it's not that people aren't whizzing around the world now in great quantities, many more than before, but there are still places you can go where you become different. You don't go there as just an observer. You change. They change you, and you also, while you're there, I think you are you become part of a place. If you're interested in these things, you become part of a place, not just a condescending visitor or even a humble visitor, but one absorbs things. And I think part of the magic of that and the interest is it in my life anyway has been staying long enough in places to learn languages, or at least to be able to make oneself understood, and to feel a sort of not inferiority or humility, I don't mean that, but to feel, yes, this is different, and maybe one of the last places on earth to be different.
Yeah, and what I would say about one difference between the world of the novel and the world that we inhabit historically is that a place in a novel does not disappear.
That's a nice
Whereas
idea.
In geographically, places are disappearing all the time before our eyes. But I know that there's one novel or series of novels that you and I hold very dear, which is Lawrence Durrell's The Four Quartets. And that Alexandria that he describes in The Four Quartets is long gone, but it will always be there in Lawrence
and
Durrell's Four Quartets.
People disparage this, and I can't imagine why, because I think those books are, they've been absolutely fascinating to me. And he was, because I knew his work first when I was again, I keep talking about when I was young, but I was young once. But he was a good poet, and I knew him first as a poet, and I still have volumes of his poetry. And I don't know if he went on after the huge success he had with his novels. I don't know if he went on writing poetry. Maybe somebody knows that. But he was a fine poet, and that's the way I first knew his work.
Well, I think it's extraordinary. But I asked one of my colleagues at Stanford in the English department, because I couldn't find anyone in our English department who knew anything about Lawrence Durrell.
Oh.
And he said, well, we consider that his prose is too purple,
oh,
which of course is ridiculous, because he is, you know, master prose
all very
writer.
Young
people. No. No. But there's something about the writerliness of a book like The Four Quartets, which is not in tune with what the unwriterly
absolutely
quality that writers cultivate these
and
days.
And yet it's not as if it's outdated.
Not
or
at all. Yeah.
Now we don't think that way or anything like that. It has its own character. Yes, how interesting that is. Yes.
Can we take one more? Yes.
I didn't hear.
You can read her and reread her and reread her again.
So you're getting high points.
Yes.
Against, at the expense of Lawrence Jarrell.
I have to confess, he's a very dear friend of mine.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I for one, I mean, I think that Lawrence Jarrell rereads very well. At least I've only read the Four Quartets twice, and I started rereading a little bit of it over the summer. I said, I have to put this down, otherwise I'm going to reread the whole thing again, because it's... But it depends. Each reader has his or her own fascination.
It's nice he comes up, because I keep a strong feeling for him, and he was at one time all the rage, and now she classes, but he'll turn up again. I'm not worried about him. Someone worried about, but not about him.
So, Harriet, I think we've come to the end of our hour. Is that the case? Yeah.
Thank you all for coming, and surely you have